You know the funeral march, the one they play in cartoons and stuff, the na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. You know who wrote that?
No.
Chopin.
Really?
Yeah.
Chopin.
Chopin, the great Polish composer who moved to France and died of consumption. Back when they called it that.
It's so romantic. Well, we're talking death, aren't we?
That's right.
Welcome to October, when the veil thins and the membrane between the two worlds becomes slim enough for spirits to glide in between. And we like to celebrate that. And that's what we're going to do this month on Arts ID with this episode. It's the death episode, Daedalus. And I am so excited about this episode.
I hear dead people.
I'm Gretchen Giles.
I'm Daedalus Howell. But this week, I'm Daedalus Dead. Liz Howell.
I get it.
See, I had to spell it out.
So we're going to hear all kinds of voices, all kinds of attitudes, all kinds of points of view about death from an art gallery in Grayton that is the only fine art funerary urn gallery in the United States, to different people, luminaries in the North Bay talking about music they'd like to hear at their own funeral, well, if they were there to hear it, to a puppet show that's been repurposed for radio and that is deadly good, to Funeral Food by Michelle Anna Jordan, to a little look at Stanley Mouse, the great Grateful Dead artist who made it, the skeleton and the roses that we all know so instantly well, which he tells us he and Alton Kelly lifted from a pretty surprising source. We'll hear about that with Bruce Robinson. Well, let's get this party started. So get ready for a good slice of death. This is Arts ID.
You know Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's Five Stages of Death?
Absolutely.
I know one's denial.
Yeah.
Right? One's bargaining. Uh-huh. Another is drinking and something about sleeping around. And
That goes under anger, by the way.
Oh, I see. Do you know what they are?
I think they are denial, anger, bargaining, something, and acceptance.
There you go. Well, whatever number four is, we'll probably hear it and the others in this next piece with Conrad Bishop and Elizabeth Fuller. They're two performers, husband and wife team, who write and produce their own material. And this is kind of a snapshot of somebody's last few minutes. In fact, specifically five last minutes.
They call themselves The Independent Eye, and they're based in West County. And this was originally conceived as a puppet show, but they've adapted it for radio.
Mark, roll tape.
Mr. Leonard.
Huh?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. What? Nurse?
On the dot.
5 minutes.
Max.
Then what?
Bingo!
What? You come in with a hypodermic or hemlock? I mean, you don't mean...
You're in the system.
Hold on. Now, there's a lot of shows where the guy dies at the end, but they don't just last 5 minutes.
It's all a talent show, Mr. Leonard. Life is just a way of attracting attention.
Wait. There's five stages to this. I read this. It was a bestseller. Denial?
Right. You're in a state of denial.
I am not.
See?
No, all this stuff, the swine flu, the bird flu, global warming, communist menace, Armageddon, it's all crap, which I could demonstrate if I had more time, but I've only got four minutes.
Oh, you'd better get on with your stages.
Denial, anger, bargaining, what?
Total freak out.
Freak out? Look, if I was some hotshot movie star, you'd give me more than 5 minutes. Check my resume. It's meaningful. There's a story that's being told.
Every human life has value. We should always pretend that's true.
Three minutes.
Okay, bargaining.
Could I see my kids? Say goodbye to my kids?
Mr. Leonard, it's unhealthy to cling. Our children are not ours. They are their own unique persons and have very short attention spans.
Health insurance, can I get a refund?
Mr. Leonard, we don't really care about your hemorrhoids. This is radio. We're concerned with your entertainment value.
Okay, I'm not headline material, but I'm putting up a fight. They do movies about guys fighting the odds, and they have this life-affirming will to live.
Well, maybe one of these nice people out there will make you into a movie.
Please.
Say please.
I said please.
Please.
Please!
That's lovely. It reminds me of the days when people said, please. You know, lots of people at this point get more spiritual.
Oh, God. Oh, God, 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 God. Oh, God. Oh, my God, 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 God.
Excuses.
Two minutes.
Oh, time for despair. Want some water?
Yeah, okay.
we charge by the cup.
Help!
No, we just had our fundraising week, Mr. Leonard. We met our goal.
Where'd it go? I grew up in the Midwest. My mom was a bookkeeper. My dad was drunk. I went to college. I got married, I think. I had kids. Then a trip to Yellowstone. I remember a girl named Janice. I'm seeing headlights. And a puppet show. TV puppet show when I was a kid. Yeah, there was a dragon.
Hi, kids.
That wasn't him. His name was Ollie.
Well, shake me like a dish rag and suck me like a pickle.
One minute. I'd like to recite a poem.
The final stage of acceptance.
Something beautiful. I think that I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree.
10, 9.
It is hung with
8,
snow upon the bough.
7,
and stands along
6,
the woodland ride.
Lovely, dark, and deep. 5.
The woods are
4,
lovely, dark,
3,
and deep.
2,
but,
1.
But only God can make a tree.
Time. Mr. Leonard, you need to wheeze or something. We can't just have dead air.
Sound effect.
Encore?
Next.
You know how comedians say they killed, or there's a punchline, or there's all this violence and death and mayhem with comedy. What do you think we just heard? Was that comedy or was that poetry?
Well, there was a lot of mayhem in it, that's for sure, and there was an odd chuckle. Odd. That was Conrad Bishop and Elizabeth Fuller. They're a company based in West County, and they actually conceived that piece to do with puppets.
I thought it worked well. It was kind of as a standalone thing. I don't think you need puppets.
Well, evidently, when they perform it live and you can actually see it, at the very end, when Leonard does expire, they pull the puppet off, and you can see the hand and the fingers wiggle, and then they sort of crumple. And
the naked dying hand. Isn't that a shot in every horror film, the hand?
It really is.
Okay.
It really is. Well, that was great work by Conrad Bishop and Elizabeth Fuller. Hey, I'm Gretchen Giles.
I'm Daedalus Howell.
This is Arts ID.
I would imagine that since the advent of recorded music, shortly thereafter, someone decided to play a tune at a funeral. It's cheaper than a band, and there's probably a sentimental association. This has been going on for at least, a century? Right?
Well, absolutely. And there was a tradition, of course, in before recorded music, that there would be a simple, you know, tune of some kind. There's all kinds of, you know, traditional American songs and traditional European songs related to death that are intended to help the spirit pass.
But now we have a tradition where people play songs
right.
that they've loved, or their loved ones play songs that they presume their past loved ones have loved. And I wonder, do you have a song?
Well, this is the thing. You know, we're about to hear David Templeton interviewing a lot of people about music they would like to have played at their own funerals. And I was really struck as I was listening to it earlier that no, because why? Because I'm not going to die, Daedalus. This is why. I just have not gotten to that spot yet. I can't actually believe it. I mean, that's for goldfish, you know?
Right,
that's So, no. How about yourself, though?
I don't either. And I'll tell you why. Because I don't want to bum anyone out on a song.
Uh-huh.
You play a song at a funeral, that song is dead. That song no longer gets airplay on one's iPod.
That's true.
You know, that's the death song for mm-hmm. whomever it was who died. And I find that some of the choices are kind of mawkish and kind of trite. Not with those who have shared their the notions with us in this piece, but like at the funerals I've been to, and I'm like, really? Over the rainbow again? You know? And so...
But it leaves you with a bad taste in your mouth for the dearly departed.
Yeah. And I think to myself, there's no way in hell that dude would have played that.
Right.
At least not that version.
Right.
You know?
Well, of course, funerals are to placate and comfort the living. So let's hear a nice collection of songs people would like to have played at their funerals. Roll it, Mark.
I am gonna die. Eventually. And I will have a funeral. And at my funeral, there will be music. Funeral music, it's important. See, I want my funeral music to do what I won't be present to do. To make people laugh, to help them feel some comfort, to make them feel glad and happy to have been one of those people on earth who knew me. And I'll have to trust the music to do that. So I've chosen, in advance, the exact piece of music that I want played as my coffin is lifted up and the pallbearers carry my body out the door. Yeah, I've chosen the music for my own funeral. And guess what? I'm not alone. Believe it or not, a lot of us do think about our funerals, and we do, some of us, have a pretty good idea what songs or musical compositions ought to be played. Food writer Michelle Anna Jordan, she plans to leave behind not a will, but a playlist. Novelist Christopher Moore has made it pretty clear that his memorial should include the song Tango Till They're Sore by Tom Waits. That song, Moore sees it as the perfect dirge. Actor Conrad Bishop is kind of liking Edith Piaf's Milord for his funeral, since that song was played a lot in the scroungy little cafe near the college where he began courting his wife Elizabeth over 50 years ago. Now, how do I know all this? I know because I've been asking. I've been asking lots of notable Bay Area artists to name the tune, that special piece of music they want played at one moment or another during their eventual funeral. The answers range from the smart to the smart alecky, from the serious to the seriously messed up. Political satirist and author Will Durst, who's never minded upsetting the apple cart, expects his funeral music to reflect his own weird wit and dark sense of humor.
Warren Zevon has a couple of great songs. You know, there's Lawyers, Guns and Money, which is fun to sing, and I would want all my mourners to sing. And then there's Excitable Boy, because he dug up her grave and built a cage from her bones.
I was gambling in Havana. I took a little risk. Send lawyers, guns, and money. Dad, get me out of this.
Ha! It turns out a lot of us do think about our funerals, and we do, some of us, have a pretty good idea what songs or musical compositions ought to be played. This is Bruno Ferrandis, conductor of the Santa Rosa Symphony, whose top funeral pick turns out to be a really obscure funeral march.
Well, at my own funeral, that's a very interesting question because I never thought about that, you know, of funeral. But one music has always touched me. It's called the Trauer Music by Paul Hindemith. And this music really touched me to death. I mean, it was probably my favorite funeral music of all time because it is extremely simple, slow, as a funeral march should be. It haunts you. It's very haunting, very mysterious. Bam, bam, bam. I would not mind that I play that for my death, because it's really a music that touches me to the bones. I mean, I must say that goes to the bones, right to the bones.
Touched to the bones. That's pretty much the way Richard Peterson feels. He's the film programmer for the Rafael Film Center. The way he feels about his choice.
The song that I most like played at my funeral, I guess it bothers me sometimes that I've actually thought about this, is the song Lost in the Stars. That's written by Kurt Vile and with lyrics by Maxwell Anderson, and specifically the version sung by Elvis Costello. It sounds like a spiritual, but it also is a song where you really don't know where you are in the universe. You know, it's about God, but it's about God maybe going away. So it's a song that deals with religion, but it's not exactly religious. It's not like, you know, going into the arms of the Lord. It's more a song about God withdrawing his arms from humanity.
What's interesting about David Balakrishnan's choice, he's the violinist and founder of the Turtle Island Quartet, is that considering he's known for his groundbreaking jazz compositions, he wants to be buried to a piece of music that, though definitely beautiful, is anything but jazzy.
Be one of the great compositions that I love of the Western classical work. So what I came to was a Brahms symphony, movement number 4 of the Second Symphony. And that's going to seem like a pretty safe choice in a lot of ways, but it's got a personal meaning to me. One of the first things that I fell in love with that was music. Brilliant, triumphant, pure genius, total clarity of the greatest that mankind can ever achieve to, and what we're built for. It just makes my chest want to explode when I hear it. Every time I listen to it to this day, it just gives me this feeling of that's the ultimate in what a human can give artistically.
Celtic harper Patrick Ball has made a career out of performing the music of Turlough O'Carolan, so his choice of funeral music comes as no big surprise.
Well, the piece of music that, the only piece of music that really comes to mind is a piece called She Beg, She More, which is a tune which was supposedly written by Turlough O'Carolan, the blind itinerant harp player from the 17th and 18th centuries. And in English, it simply means the little fairy hill and the big fairy hill. And I ran across this piece just before I began to play the harp. And it's actually the reason that I did begin to play the harp, because I was so, well, enchanted by this tune that that I wanted to learn to play it. And ever since that time, I've played it just about all my concerts. And so the way I figure is, well, heck, artistically anyway, I came in with this song, so physically I might as well go out with the song.
Monologist Josh Kornbluth's funeral sounds like it will be very artsy and probably a whole lot of laughs.
Well, I guess I won't be sad when I'm dead, you know, because I'll be dead. But the song that I thought about playing, the first one that came to mind was a song by Bjork called The Anchor Song.
This is where I'm staying. This is my home.
It's always, I mean, it's a beautiful song. It's just a sort of simple lyrics, and then she repeats it twice, you know, which might be helpful if, you know, they take extra time lowering my coffin or inserting my urn. I think, I mean, there were very few words. I live by the ocean, and during the night, I dive into it, down to the bottom, underneath all currents, and drop my anchor. This is where I'm staying. This is my home. And then also Bjork, you know, she's from Iceland. I picture it as being very cold and beautiful, and it seems like a good place for a dead person.
Down to the bottom.
Dan St. Paul's baseball-themed comedy routine, Heaven vs. Hell, has become more or less legendary. So the image of his coffin being carried from the broom, maybe by a bunch of guys in Giants jerseys, as Take Me Out to the Ball Game is played, is not that far-fetched.
At my funeral, I would like them to play Take Me Out to the Ball Game. I have often commented that I am not afraid of death. I am only afraid of no baseball. And so I would hope going out that way that when I reach the other side, I can go to a few games. Or even better, I would love to announce. Take me that would be much better. If I could announce, like, the afterlife All-Star game, that would be something to really look forward to. I may even hasten my death if I knew that that's what was going to happen.
Get back, so it's root, root, root for the home team. They don't win, it's a shame. It's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out.
Director Terry Zwigoff is usually known for controlling all the details of his films.
I'm not going to hear it, so I don't care. Whatever makes my wife happy, or she wants to play. Well, I can't think of a, you know, like I say, like I just can't think of those terms since I'm dead. I just don't care. I'm not going to be around to care. Doesn't bother me. You can play Elton John for all I care.
By now, you're probably beginning to think about your own funeral, wondering what music you'd like to have. You keep doing that. We'll be back later in the show with a few more North Bay artists describing the songs, some of them pretty out there, that they expect to have played when they shuffle off their mortal coil. You said, "Sorry, honey, if I don't change the pace,
I can't miss another day." Hey, Daedalus, I love Reed Martin's idea that his funeral could just be like a, you know, a casting.
Like an audition.
Yeah. Yeah. Bring the headshot.
To play himself, to replace himself.
That's right. It's fantastic. That very, I think the sort of presumption and vanity is brilliant.
That's how one should be, you know, when and thinking
absolutely.
Of one's own death. Yeah. Yeah. I do. I've changed my tune, though.
Oh.
So to speak.
Do you actually have one now?
I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know that dirgy kind of that people do often in choruses,
mm-hmm.
at least around my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd like that.
And that would be because?
Because it won't destroy a song,
uh-huh.
and it'll leave people with this kind of lingering notion that something really tragic has happened.
Well, they're going to feel that way anyway, Dee.
No, I want them to carry it with them forever.
Sort of a tattoo, a musical tattoo on the soul.
Right.
Excellent. Well, that was great work by David Templeton, and we'll hear a little bit more of that later on in the show.
May he rest in peace.
Next up, Robin Pressman interviews Maureen Lemazny. Maureen runs Funaria, Art Honors Life. It is the nation's only fine art gallery devoted to funerary urns. And Daedalus, these are not like what you might imagine when you think about a funeral urn that ashes are kept in.
This is not your father's urn,
no,
as they would say.
Indeed. I've been to a Funaria before and seen an urn that was composed entirely of a 1960s vacuum cleaner. The ashes are kept where the bag would be for the vacuum cleaner. It was outfitted with a little video screen, and it played a song at all times, which would be Seasons in the Sun.
Oh,
do you remember
God.
That? Da 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 da.
Yeah.
We had Seasons in the Sun.
Was the piece called
Sun.
Death Sucks?
Yeah, pretty much. But she has specialized in these, in people who will do really unusual conceptual things, like, for example, it has been proven by an artist that the human body can be contained in 32 pencils. And you can have your ashes put into pencils. And then the way that you store the ashes is when you sharpen the pencil,
uh-huh.
it goes into a box that eventually becomes the urn.
Kind of a new spin on the poison pen letter.
Indeed.
Kind of a deathy
so,
pencil.
Robin's going to talk to Maureen about, you know, how you can decorate your home with your dearly beloved.
Mark, roll it.
Maureen Lemazny wants you to leave something behind. She wants to aestheticize your death, or at the very least, to give you a new way to think about your final resting place. For the last 10 years, she's been building a movement she calls Funaria. It's housed in an old fruit-drying warehouse in Grayton. It's a gallery called Art Honors Life, the gallery at Funaria, and it's a place like no other, anywhere.
It's a gallery that is the first of its kind. It's moving into the mainstream, but it's currently still an emerging genre, the contemporary funerary art genre. So having an incubator kind of environment right there in Grayton is really helpful. I would love to see urn and vessel stores that are just beautiful galleries scattered all over the country, because I think that is the best way to get the message out that there are artists creating exquisite work that can serve as our final shelters. We're not only human, but that each of us is a really creative, unique person. We can express that creativity and individuality even after we're gone.
Since mounting her first show at Fort Mason Center in San Francisco in 2001, Maureen has sought out artists all around the world who create urns and lidded vessels and collected a regular stable of 45 artists and a library of 1,500 other artists working in the form. Over the years, she's recruited artists who haven't thought about making works that could store ashes, for example, and tried to convince them to turn their hollow objects or lidded vessels into funerary art. While some artists just weren't ready to take on the subject of death.
At the same time, there were other artists who said, thank you so much for offering this venue because I've been making urns quietly on the side for families who are purchasing other of my forms, other kinds of objects. And at some point, they've asked me to make an urn for their mom or dad. And it's been a very moving and meaningful experience to do that. It's not as though you can go to a craft show and go by one booth that's selling teacups and another that's selling wind chimes, and then the next one is selling funeral urns.
At Funaria, there are urns and vessels of every size and shape. They're made from ceramic, stainless steel, beads, papier-mâché, bronze, and marble. But Maureen's ever-growing stable of artists has burst the boundaries to explore new ways to hold or to scatter or disperse our earthly remains. When she put out a request for artistic solutions for her show called Scattered, she received bronze spoons and other implements for strewing ashes, and she heard from a young British artist called Nadine Jarvis, who imagined a series of bird feeders.
And these were teardrop-shaped objects, or gourd-shaped in some respects, that are meant to be created from beeswax, cremated remains, and birdseed. They'd be hung on a tree somewhere outside, and the birds would come along, ingest the seeds, and scatter them and your ashes at the same time throughout wherever they travel, which is a wonderfully evocative idea. And then as the piece is consumed, it also breaks down and lands on the ground. Another is an egg-shaped piece called Rest in Pieces that is a very fragile ceramic piece that you would hang from twine on a tree in a forest, say, fill it with ashes, and then over time, the wind and animals, it would buffet it around, storms, who knows what it would be exposed to, but in its own time, in its own place, it would fall and shatter and scatter the ashes in that way, too.
The funeral industry doesn't truck in one-of-a-kind pieces of art. It takes a gallery to provide the singular experience of making a unique statement, an artist's representation of oneself expressed in one's final resting place. There's a marble sarcophagus in the current show. It's made by Croatian stone sculptor Ante Marinović, who comes to teach every summer at Stone Sculptor Supply in Guerneville.
He was brought to the gallery last year and was so inspired by what he'd seen. He works on big, huge public monuments throughout the world, and he hadn't worked on the small scale, but when we showed him what was in the gallery, he asked what he could do and what he might create in this genre. And knowing that he was a magnificent stone sculptor, I suggested an updated version of an Etruscan sarcophagus would really be lovely to see. But also, I would really love to see urns carved from salt, because I'm always looking for biodegradable options. A lot of people really do want to simply melt back into the earth. So he came back a few weeks later with a gorgeous white marble stone sarcophagus and a number of pieces in different designs carved from solid blocks of salt that people mistake for alabaster. I love it when people come to the gallery and they think, ooh, what is that? That looks so translucent. And when I tell them that it's a solid block of salt, carved from salt, they're stunned and delighted. And the thought process that he went through in creating these pieces and that particular design is something that only artists can do, and which is why artists are so critically important to our culture. Working to elevate the status of artists and their role in society is something that's important to me.
Nancy Josephson, a singer, songwriter, and founder of The Angel Band, who often plays with her husband David Bromberg's band backing her up, is also a maker of funerary art. She has three pieces in the gallery's current exhibit. In fact, her own urn is there. It's a whimsical beaded piece that, among other things, holds her first baby tooth. And spelled out in letter tiles among the beads?
It spells out, does this make my ashes look big? How could you not love that?
Maureen says that about two-thirds of the people who come to the gallery are looking for their own final resting place.
A couple in New York, they came to the gallery, they made an appointment to see if they could find a piece that the two of them could share, that their ashes would be commingling in. And I was really stunned, frankly, by what they found, because they look quite conservative, but the piece they chose is this really delightful, whimsical wood piece called Their Last Love Shack. And no one would ever recognize it as an urn. It's it has two heads, a male head and a female head. So these are very dramatic pieces, but also charming and whimsical. And it's about a 37-inch tall piece. So right now, it stands in their entryway and greets visitors who don't have any idea that that's ultimately their final resting place.
How heavy or how much mass is there in
the cremated remains?
How big is a collection of cremated
Larger
remains?
Larger than most people think, and they weigh considerably more than a lot of people imagine. I think that there's a misconception, because I call them ashes. I prefer them the more historic kind of ashes to ashes, more biblical kind of reference.
So 10 years ago, Maureen Lomasny came up with the idea of, and the name, Funaria. She contacted artists around the world and is now the repository of this unique creative endeavor, add a new dimension to planning for or thinking about our death. And she adds another dimension to dealing with grief.
It gives me a great deal of pleasure, and I know that it's meaningful for people who are looking exactly for this. One of my dreams is really to have a flagship store on Madison Avenue in New York where at night, when people are walking by and the windows are wide open, floor to ceiling, two stories tall, and spotlights are shining on gorgeous artworks on pedestals, and people walking by have no idea what they're looking at other than that it's a gorgeous art gallery, and then find out that it's funerary art. That, to me, is a means of changing our perceptions of death and the objects that can be used to represent us. It's really something that is still growing, and we've been working on building this awareness and a marketplace for 10 years. And I think that we are finally reaching a tipping point. I'm hoping so.
The Funaria Gallery has just opened a new exhibit called Ashes to Art, and it features Nancy Josephson's beaded urn and more than 70 original contemporary urns, reliquaries, jewelry, and more. Art Honors Life, the gallery at Funaria, is on Bowen Street in Greaton, which is not that large a town. You turn left at the second stop sign in town and go 2.5 blocks. The Ashes to Art exhibit runs through December 18th. For Arts ID, I'm Robin Pressman.
Hey, Dee, have we talked about me recently? Can we talk back? can we get back to me?
Oh, are you in this show, too?
I am. You know, my great-grandmother was a Christian Scientist.
Okay.
And Christian Scientists don't believe in doctors, for example. She decided in late middle age, when she wasn't quite very old, that she was ready to die, and she took to her bed. And she stayed there for 12 years. Hale, hearty, angry, nightgowned. And she did finally die of well, basically advanced old age, but there had not been anything wrong with her. And of course, because she wouldn't go to a doctor, no one could ever tell her. It was just pure spite.
Right.
When she did pass, I'm afraid to say that we were all sort of glad to see her go. Mm-hmm. So we're about to present a theatrical piece, a monologue written by Judith Martin. It's called Talking With, and it's read by Sherry Lee Miller. It comes to us from Cinnabar Theater in Petaluma. Let's hear it, Mark.
The day my mother found out she was dying, she asked me to go out and buy her these clear glass marbles. Dad and I hadn't even known she was ill, which was nothing new. Whenever you asked my mother if she was ill, she would throw things at you. Sesame buns, the editorial page, a handful of hair ribbons. Do not, she would say, suggest things to suggestible people. Anyway, I bought her the marbles, and she counted 90 of them out and put them in this old cut glass bowl. Apparently, the doctor had given her 3 months, and she set great store by doctors. So she counted out 90 clear glass marbles and set them in the bowl on her bedside table. Then she went out and spent $1,200 on nightgowns. She said, "In my family, you are only dying when you take to your bed. And that, my darlings, is where I am going." And she did. I told her it seemed a little medieval to lie in state up there, but she said she didn't want to be distracted from what she loved, us, and that she wanted to mull. And she said there was nothing outside except drugstores and supermarkets and dry cleaners, and that given her situation, they were beneath her dignity. I asked her what she intended to do up there, and she said study French, visit with us, and maybe call a few pals. Study French. She said she made a pledge to herself years ago that she would die bilingual. Dad and I cried a lot, but she didn't. And all day, every day, she would hold one of these marbles in her hand. She said it made the day longer. We'd sit with her after dinner and talk about issues. She told us she was too far gone for gossip or what we ate for lunch. Then we'd all turn in, and in a little while, just before I'd drift off, I'd hear this. Happened every night. After the third or fourth day, I saw one on the floor and started to pick it up, but she said, "Leave it." She said it very sharply. I asked, "How come?" She said she was learning to let go of them. Oh, she passed the time. There were things she wanted. She made out a list of children's books from her own childhood, and we got as many of them as we could from the library. She said they were still the only good books she'd ever read. She wrote notes to friends and included a recipe in each and every one of them. We got out the big cookie tin full of snapshots that somehow never became a scrapbook. She liked that. She showed my father how to do the medical insurance and how she handled the accounts. We went through her jewelry. She called it wrapping it up. "Well, this is good," she'd say. "I'm wrapping it up." Mom had the television moved up into her room, and she called me aside to say that it was entirely possible that she might reach a stage where she really wouldn't know what she was watching, but that I must promise her that I'd keep it on PBS. Later on, when it started getting hard, she told Dad and me that she would like to spend more time alone. "I'm afraid," she said, "that I'm going to have to do this more or less by myself." She said that she was glad, and she hoped we would be, that this was arranged so that you got less attached to the people you loved at the end. The next period isn't worth going into. It was just hard. The last thing she asked for was a picture we had in the front entrance hall of a Labrador retriever she and Dad had owned when they were first married. He was, she said, a perfectly dreadful dog. "When you are young," she said, "you believe in the perfectibility of dogs." I was in bed 2 weeks ago Wednesday toward dawn, and then this. Dad and I ran in there. The bedside table was turned over, and she was gone. Dead. When the emergency medical people got there, they found this. One last marble. The rest spilled when the table fell, but this one was still in her hand. I keep it. I keep it in my hand all day. It makes the day longer.
Death is kind of depressing, Daedalus.
Really?
Yeah. This is going to be performed, isn't it? Is there going to be a performance of this piece?
There will be at Spreckles in the winter.
You know, Pasco was at Spreckles. It has passed. The Pacific Alliance Stage Company. So now Spreckles is using its theater for all kinds of different performances, which is pretty exciting, actually. So I hope it's in the Black Box Theater. We'll be back with more in just a second. Arts ID.
The Grateful Dead. The Skeleton. Where from?
Well, we're going to hear where from. It's really surprising, actually. News director Bruce Robinson has interviewed the great graphic artist Stanley Mouse for the upcoming piece about the Grateful Dead icon that Stanley and Alton Kelly devised, which they stole sort of magnificently from an ancient text, as you're going to hear in the next segment.
They're grave robbers, technically. They took the bones and realigned them and pretended they were theirs.
But let's hear a little bit more about Stanley Mouse from Bruce Robinson. Roll it, Mark.
Some people's personal passions emerge early. It may not become their life's work, although it often does, but that driving interest, that individual obsession, is often established, for better or worse, long before thoughts of jobs or career come into play. That was the case for young Stanley Miller, whose talent for constant sketching and cartooning was abundantly obvious by the time he reached junior high school.
I was instantly famous in the seventh grade. I would alter all the school books, and people at the end of the term would fight to get my book for next year.
Mere margins were scarcely enough to satisfy his creative urge. Our young artist, now embracing the nickname Mouse, bestowed by an unknown classmate, eventually found a much bigger canvas, of sorts, near his Detroit area high school.
We hung out at this place across the street from the high school called The Box. And actually, the original name on it was the Flying Saucer Grill, which is a great name. But everybody called it The Box. So one day, the owner painted the place white, and it looked like a white canvas. And my dad had a sign painting business, so we used his truck that said signs on it and ladders and put our uniforms on and went up and painted it. The problem was that I had a hard time not signing it, so I signed Mouse on it, and everybody knew I did it. Monday morning, the principal called me in and she kicked me out of school, and I quit, which was good. I went directly to art school at 16. Tell me the cause.
For a time, he happily combined that with a burgeoning career creating airbrushed art at car shows, on everything from muscle cars to t-shirts. But before long, he succumbed to the siren song of San Francisco.
I was born in California, and as soon as I was old enough, like a salmon, I returned. I heard there were a lot of really great things happening in San Francisco, and I liked San Francisco. So I came out to check it out, and it was fantastic. They were doing posters for rock and roll concerts, and I said I could do that, and I just jumped into it and started doing it.
It was here that Stanley Mouse made his mark. He quickly found a kindred spirit in Alton Kelly, another artist, with connections to The Family Dog, a production operation that was putting on scores of concerts and dances, all of which needed posters to promote them. Each poster had to have a strong central image as its visual hook, and Mouse and Kelly soon discovered a rich resource for those images deep in the San Francisco Public Library.
In back of the library, they had giant rooms of books of poster art, from historical posters and just everything, and we would go in there and study.
It was there, in fact, that Mouse first found the image that became his most enduring subject.
We had a job to do the poster for the Grateful Dead, who at the time was just another new band with a great name. So we went to the library and looking for something that would be a great picture for the Grateful Dead poster, and we found the Skeleton and Roses from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, looked at it and said, this says Grateful Dead all over it. So we made a copy of it and built a poster around it. It came out really good, and they liked it and adopted it as their logo for years to come.
It turned out that was more than just the beginning of a beautiful friendship. It also became the basis for a long and rewarding professional association.
We did several posters for the Grateful Dead, and then they asked us to do their album cover. Then we went on to do the first 8 Grateful Dead album covers, and a few more after that.
That was an unforeseen realization of a long-held aspiration.
When I was in Detroit, I was really into the Motown scene, and I had a friend who was the art director there, and he gave me a job of doing a record cover for, this is like 63, I think, for Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, and it was for Mickey's Monkey. And I did it on a pizza box lid, and I got paid $35 for it. Even after that, I said to myself, well, it seems impossible to do album covers. It seemed like such a pie in the sky. But then it started happening, and the bands that we were doing posters for started making album covers, like Steve Miller made an album, and we did the Pegasus Flying Horse on it, and a lot of Grateful Dead stuff. After Woodstock, we got a job to do Jimi Hendrix cover, and we finished it, and unfortunately, he died on us, and the record never came out, and the cover got lost into obscurity.
Mouse also created the covers for the series of Journey's biggest selling records, all of which are built around a logo he designed, in which his roots as an automotive airbrush specialist can be readily discerned. But concert posters remained his primary creative outlet for many years, including one that drew on another iconic image of the 60s.
Eras have different images, and then the big one was the Zigzag Man. People were painting them on their T-shirts and walking around with hand-painted Zigzag Man on their T-shirts. And we thought it'd be great to do a poster with the Zigzag Man on it. But we'd probably get busted. Everybody was paranoid at the time. Or else Zigzag themselves would bust us. But we finally did it, and it was for a Big Brother concert. And it came out, and we went through the studio and cleaned up all our weed and our seeds and made sure it was squeaky clean. And I think I even left town. Went out to Marin or something. And nothing happened. Zigzag was trying to find a way to advertise to pot smokers, but they couldn't do it because it was like taboo. So here we come with a $1 million ad campaign for Zigzag, and they just shut their mouth.
That was a one-shot subject, but the skeletons have turned out to have an unexpected staying power. And that's just fine with Mouse.
The reason I like doing Grateful Dead stuff is because before, when I was painting Hot Rods and Monsters on T-shirts, I painted a lot of skeletons, and I like painting skeletons. It was kind of one of my trademarks. And then when I got to do Grateful Dead stuff, it fit right in. And I'm still doing skeletons, more than ever, probably.
These days, the skeletons of Stanley Mouse can be seen at his Rock and Roses Gallery, along with his other art. It's just off the plaza in downtown Healdsburg, but there's one notable exception. That would be the white, fleshless figure that looks on from a corner of Mouse's West Sebastopol studio, a mute model and perhaps inspiration as ever new skeletal likenesses appear from the artist's brushes.
I just love hearing Stanley talk. You know, all my years at the Bohemian, Stanley has been like, you know, he gives us 2 covers a year. For a long time, we were running a fine art painting by him every single week because he really loves to do nudes and fine art painting. But also, we recently ran a story in the Bohemian about Joel Selvin, the great San Francisco Chronicle music writer.
That's right.
Just retired. And he's written a book called Smartass. And in the book Smartass, he talks about getting Stanley Mouse a new liver.
Wait. How do you get a new liver?
Yeah, Stanley was near death. And this must have been in the 70s or the 80s. And Joel heard about it and wrote a front page story in the Chronicle about how Stanley Mouse needed a new liver. And the next day, an area surgeon had a liver flown in from Arizona and saved Stanley Mouse's life.
So clearly this is before the advent of the internet. Otherwise, he would have just gone on Craigslist or something.
Exactly, okay. And gotten a liver that way. But it was also the power of print to save lives, ooh. I might say, if I get a chance here to say a good word
print
for print.
Print is dead, Gretchen. Print
so
is dead.
So I hear. And this is the death episode of Arts ID. So, Dave, I think we're going to hear a little bit more funeral music, okay? You ready for that?
Let's do it later.
Oh, no.
I'm getting too sad.
Is that you like that?
Let's pretend this is an old record, and we've just gone over the first side, and we'll flip it and start it again later. But I have to go get a drink first.
All right. Okay. A stiff one.
Most of the folks I spoke to when describing the song they'd like played at their funeral had fairly well thought out reasons for choosing whatever it is they've chosen. Then there's stand-up comic Arthur Gauss.
I always think, like, if I get really viciously beat up in an alley behind a bar in sort of a weird sadistic way, I definitely want to hear, like, that's when the song Children of the Revolution by T-Rex need to be playing. Similarly, like, if I ever play on a Stanley Cup winning hockey team, when the Stanley Cup is handed to me, they need to be playing More Than a Feeling by Boston. I really sort of reject the idea that somebody should try to play a pop song that relates somehow to the life and times of Arthur Gauss. Rather, I would play a song that doesn't make any sense, but that I really like, and just to sort of free associate a song that everybody likes with a commemoration of me, you know? What I really like about Video Killed the Radio Star is that it's what I want and it doesn't make any sense. The original album version on vinyl, volume turned up very loudly.
René de la Prada of the Celtic band Coolin's Hounds and actor Reed Martin of the Reduced Shakespeare Company are both known for their accordion playing skills, but they have very differing opinions about funeral music.
Well, I've never thought about this topic before, but at my funeral, I would like to have the most classic all funeral songs played, which is Amazing Grace on the bagpipes. I guess that'll make everyone cry, so after that, I'd probably want to have a livelier tune. Maybe girls just want to have fun, celebrate the happy stuff and the joy of having parties and working hard but still playing. And then I'd want to have, like, some more funny Irish music. Just learn this rebel tune called Nell Flaherty's Drake that's got about 40 different Irish curses in it. So it'd be kind of fun to curse the folks at the funeral in a lighthearted way, and they can't get back at me anymore because I'm dead.
You know, I'm of Scottish descent. I'm probably 27.3%. Scottish, and all my relations like to have bagpipes at their weddings and funerals, and I just want to go on the record right now publicly, no effing bagpipes. What I think I would like at the big dramatic moment is from Life of Brian, always look on the bright side of life, because the last laugh is on you.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life.
Well, yeah, maybe we can make it a twofer. Maybe it could be, since I'll be dead, we'll need replacements for the Reduced Shakespeare Company. So maybe we'll have them do a comic monologue, tell a couple of jokes, and then maybe an up-tempo and a ballad. Of their choice that would be appropriate at my funeral. So, you know, kind of a potpourri.
Theater publicist Kim Taylor has always felt she was born in the wrong decade, preferring, right up to her choice of funeral music, the days of the big band era.
Well, I love the tune Don't Say Goodbye. It's a Ray Nobles orchestration. He was a British band leader, and the song is sung by Al Boley.
Don't say goodbye, somehow it's wrong.
And, you know, it's just one of those songs that is very whimsical, but yet bittersweet. It's just a great dance number. I'm a publicist. I've been in theater all my life. And, you know, if I were to plan my service, it would be a big fat show with all kinds of music and dancing and entertainment. And, you know, you've got to send your audience out, you know, with an upbeat tune. You know, really, let me be honest here. When I go to heaven, I hope there's a cocktail lounge where I can smoke without anybody, you know, chastising me. And I hope Ray Nobles is playing that song.
Gabe Sacchichini, director of the American Philharmonic, believes that one's choice of music is all about leaving our loved ones with one final message.
It's the last movement of Ravel's Mother Goose Suite, and it's the apotheosis. It's called the Fairy Garden. Designing a funeral is sort of like designing any other theatrical event, right? So I think you'd want to design an event that left your friends and loved ones with a sort of a final goodbye, a sort of a closure to their relationship with you, right? And this piece, it has that feeling of ending and saying goodbye and saying I love you and going off into the light.
As for me, I've been thinking about this a long time. The piece of music I want, as my coffin is carried away, comes from an old 70s TV show. It's not the show I care about, but the tone the music sets. Upbeat, playful, a little inappropriate, and just kind of fun. I hope, as my friends and family gather to celebrate my life, those are the things they think of when they think about me. That's why I want my funeral to include Mike Post's masterpiece, the theme to the Rockford Files.
Did we survive? Are we the Walking Dead?
You know, there were no zombie stories.
You know, that's strange.
Isn't that strange?
Considering Templeton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the zombie zeitgeist.
Yeah, the zombies are everywhere.
They are indeed.
Well.
Actually, they've been all over downtown Petaluma. They've actually been out and about. Copperfield's Books has been doing a lot of zombie stuff because, well, it's one way to get people to read, too. There's been all these mashup novels lately.
That's right.
You know, Jane Austen meets zombies. And,
yeah.
As a culture, you know, we just love the undead. You know, the vampires everywhere. No vampire stories this time either.
Something's gone wrong. Something's wrong.
When we're not eating our own flesh or drinking our own blood.
I know.
We're just talking in... We're talking Walt Whitman. We've gone all over the place here today with
Somehow,
Arts ID.
Yeah, maybe this is more of a life-affirming episode than a death episode.
That's what I like about it, indeed. As the veil thins and we go back between the two worlds, talking about death, this episode of Arts ID.
You know what we didn't have?
What's that, Daedalus?
Dead air.
Nothing like death to bring out the life.
I'm Daedalus Howell.
I'm Gretchen Giles. We'll talk to you again. Arts ID.
Arts ID is a production of KRCB Radio, the North Bay Bohemian, and the Arts Council of Sonoma County. We had contributions from Conrad Bishop and Elizabeth Fuller of The Independent Eye, David Templeton, Sherry Lee Miller, and Bruce Robinson. Arts ID is produced and edited by yours truly, Robin Pressman, and engineered and mixed by Mark Fuller. You can hear it again Sunday afternoon at 4 p.m., that's Halloween, or online at artsid.org.